in our pursuit of scale, we're losing our sense of humanity because of what you read that I wrote. And it's hard to find yourself when you're distanced from others. And what we end up doing as entrepreneurs, as founders, as CEOs, really in any job, this would apply, and that is we grow, we scale, the top line growth is big, the profits are big, and what we find, we turn around and one day we realize that we have lost the thing that brought us to this place to begin with. We have become untethered to our vocation because we've become busy managing and writing checks and delegating, and pretty soon we've lost the human scale of our business that drew us to it in the first place, whatever it may be, practicing law, writing, making chocolate. It doesn't matter. The application is the same for all of those. And so what I'm suggesting is that people take a step back, take a deep breath and say, wait, what? I see the attraction here, but do I need to do this? And if I do this, how can I have a daily practice of reverse scale? That is, how can I turn this pyramid upside down and say, does this idea, this good idea, can I say that this has value if it only impacts one person? Or what if it just impacts me? Is it still worthy? Can I ascribe value to that? And in the process, am I practicing reverse scale? That is, am I practicing holding on to this line, this tether, to the thing that brought me here to begin with? And is it worth sacrificing some growth and scale in order to keep it? And I say yes.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Sean, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. So I actually was introduced to you by multiple sources. I came across your work on Seth Godin's blog, and then coincidentally, someone from your team wrote in and told me about the work that you're up to. And anybody who sends chocolate with their book is somebody I've become an instant fan of. I remember it somehow worked out really nice. I was like, I'm really craving something sweet. I was like, oh yeah, I got some chocolate with that book today. I'm going to eat it, which was delicious, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for saying that. Yeah. Appreciate it.
So I want to start with a question that I don't believe that I've started with before. And I've gathered that faith plays a really major role in your life from having read the book. And I wanted to ask about what the spiritual or religious background of your childhood was.
My dad grew up a Jew in New York City. My grandfather was from Russia. My grandmother from Hungary. Her relatives all died in the Holocaust. My mother was a Southern Baptist farm girl. So, of course, I was raised Episcopalian. But the religious background was quite dominant growing up, because when my dad was about 46 years old, he was diagnosed with lung cancer. I was 12, and he died when I was 14. And this kind of weird thing happened in our Episcopal church, and that is, there was this prayer group that would come over to our house when my dad was sick, and they would lay hands on him and say that he was going to be healed, and they spoke in tongues, which really freaked me out. And they were a little bit mean. In other words, they kind of yelled their claim of healing, and it sort of scared me. But the leader of the group told me to never speak of death with my dad. They said if I ever did that, that it would be a sign of doubt, and that he wouldn't be healed of his cancer. So every time my dad tried to bring it up, I'd push him away and say, you know, Dad, don't say that. You won't live. And he kept getting sicker. He was a lawyer like me. And he was in court the week before he died on a trial. And I was with him when he died at home. And it was the most desperate moment of my life, just begging God out loud to please not let him die and just let him live. And he didn't. And then this the two leaders from the prayer group were over a couple hours after my dad died. His body was still upstairs in their bedroom. And they brought me upstairs, these two ladies, and they actually tried to raise him from the dead. And they said that he didn't want to come back, that he liked it better where he was. So that was my religious imprint, if you will, growing up as a teenager and as a young person.
Wow. And yet, as I said, from reading the book, I got the sense that there is a tremendous amount of faith that plays a role in your life. So how in the world did that happen, despite the fact that you experienced what you just did?
When I practiced criminal defense law for 20 years before I started this chocolate factory. And I spent about 25 years after my dad's death just accomplishing every single thing that I could. Any mountain that was in front of me was there to climb. And I did all the things I could do, won all the cases, made the money. And I just felt as if there might be something more, there could be something else, and that perhaps there was another vocation waiting for me, and the vocation that I'd had for the previous 20 years was about to be shed. I just didn't know. I was clueless in how to pursue the next thing. But I read this book, Tuesdays with Maury, which I encourage anyone to read, and I would say, even though Maury was a self-described religious mutt, Buddhist, Jewish, and I believe that God spoke to me through that book. I think that God can speak to us through anything, and I think that happened through that book. And that book, oddly enough, reinvigorated my faith. And from that point on, I decided that I would go to a nearby monastery called Assumption Abbey, which is a Trappist monastery about an hour and a half from my house. And it's the place that my father spent his last night before he died. He was on a men's church retreat with some of his friends at this monastery, and I decided to go visit that place. I've been visiting it now for 18 years as a guest at first, just going there to be alone and in solitude. And over time, my faith began to really take on a feeling of reality to me. And as I was going through this difficult time of figuring out what to do next, and then about 4 or 5 years ago, I took the step of becoming a family brother. I'm not a monk. but when I'm there with the monks, I live with them behind what's called the cloister. I follow their schedule. I wake up for the first prayer service at 3:15 in the morning, and I work with them in what is called ora et labora, the balance of work and prayer. And that's what I do. And that has become a real center point in my life. So faith is, I would say, the center of my life, and the things that surround it are hopefully informed by that.
Wow. You know, I remember reading the part about losing your father, and the question that it raised for me is, what impact has that ended up having on the kind of father you've been to your children?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, as I mentioned, my dad was He was really a hero to me and was a source of comfort to me growing up, and I really looked up to him. And I think that while I tried to be that way to my kids, I think more than anything that the experience of his sickness and death so overshadowed a lot of my memories of our time together, what I've tried to do, and I should say this as an aspiration, not as a conclusion of fact, but I've tried to let that experience, be one where I can learn from that and express compassion to others, including my children. And so I think that above anything else, that experience in my dad has given me an opportunity to express compassion to my family and other people.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you're a criminal defense attorney, which I knew, and I remember reading some of the stories about the people that you defended, and I wondered if there was ever moments where there was a conflict between your faith and the people you were defending, given the things that they were being accused of.
My work as a criminal defense lawyer was really my reputation was built in the defense of murder cases, mainly because they were high profile on court TV and back in the days when court TV had money to cover trials, and so that was really how I was known. And I defended all kinds of cases, you know, everybody from accused drug dealers to people charged with very serious assault crimes or embezzlement, white collar crime cases, tax fraud, bank fraud, and then, of course, people accused of murder. And I would say that my faith, the intersection of my faith and my work, never created a conflict for me. And I think the reason is because even during those years when my faith seemed distant, really distant in my life, I still prayed. And I prayed for justice and mercy, even though, of course, I was defending people. That's what I wanted. I wanted the outcome to be one of justice tempered with mercy. And I never allowed myself to be put in a compromising ethical position. I just didn't. I fully understood the rules of ethics, and I was very careful about knowing where that line was. But there were times, you know, when judges threatened to throw me in jail, and I've had many, many conflicts with prosecutors and judges and witnesses, but I never felt as if that any of those situations put me in conflict with my faith. I just was careful to never let anything go down that path. I was protective of it.
So I have to ask you about your views on our entire criminal justice system and the prison industrial complex. And the reason this is fresh on my mind, I think it's almost serendipitous that we're having this conversation, because I was watching a documentary last night about the American prison system and how it really apparently is biased to favor the people who might be rich and guilty and definitely punish people who are innocent and poor. You may have seen it. Jay-Z produced this documentary about a young kid named Khalif Browder, who was accused of stealing a backpack, put in Rikers for 3 years, and finally let go with no explanation. And of course, he ended up committing suicide because they had put him in solitary confinement for 3 years. And you having been so up close and personal to this, what are your views on all of this?
Our current system, our current criminal justice system, is in a sad state of affairs, and candidly, it's been that way for decades. And what you said is true. I've worked with public defenders, federal public defenders, and state public defenders all over the country. In some states, it's better than it is in others, but there's absolutely no question that those people who are poor are going to end up with a worse outcome than if they had the resources to hire a private criminal defense lawyer. And not to mention the fact that the laws are even written in such a way that those of color will be treated differently when it comes to sentencing and will spend longer times in jail. And so the system is broken all the way around. So it's broken when it comes to the right to counsel and those lawyers that are available to people who can't afford a lawyer, who have a constitutional right to a lawyer. So So preparation to trial, that's broken. The appellate system as it relates to people in poverty is broken. And of course, those people who are incarcerated, are, if they're poor, they're just going to be there longer, period. And I mean, yes, I was a private criminal defense lawyer, but it gave me the opportunity to see literally in courtrooms what was happening for people who didn't have money. Now, some of the lawyers were terrible. And even if they'd only had one client, they were still terrible lawyers. These are, in some cases, state public defenders who had absolutely no business defending these serious cases. And I'm the one case that really strikes me is I had this client who I did not write about in the book, but his name was Armand Villasana, and he was before I got to him, he was represented by a state public defender. He was accused of rape, and he was given 70 years. And then the family gathered some money together and hired me for the appeal. And what was terrible is there was actually a lineup in that case. The victim, the woman, said that her accuser was Hispanic. How many Hispanic people do you think were in the lineup? One, him. Then, and yet it still went to trial. And that lineup identification wasn't thrown out. So finally, when I got it, the guy had been there in solitary confinement for 2 years, said he didn't commit this rape. So I convinced the judge before sending him away for literally the rest of his life. I said, "Judge, let me look at the evidence. Let me re-examine the evidence and have a private lab, a forensic lab, examine the clothing that the victim was wearing at the time of the rape and examine the rape kit." Come to find out, the state forensic analyst had actually found an indicator to indicate the presence of semen, and didn't give that to the prosecutor or to the defense lawyer. He just put it in a file cabinet, put it away. So I found it. I had the evidence re-examined. Meanwhile, the guy's still sitting in jail. And it turned out that that DNA on the clothing she was wearing, the DNA on the hospital sheet, and the DNA to the rape kit all matched each other and all weren't him. This guy didn't do it. And the prosecutors still fought me on it. So had the family not had the money to come hire me, he would have died in jail. And I got him out. He got out. And get this. The prosecutor called me a few years ago and said, "Sean, the FBI found a DNA profile match on that case where you defended Villasana. And they went and interviewed the man in prison somewhere in the central Midwest. And he said, yes, I did it. But it wasn't rape. It was consensual. Go ask her, the alleged woman victim of rape." She then said, when confronted, "I made the story up because I didn't want to tell my husband about an affair, but yet the statute of limitations had run, and so she couldn't be charged with perjury." Can you believe that? So all of this happened, all of it happened, because this guy didn't have money to hire a private criminal defense lawyer in his first trial. Otherwise, I believe that evidence would have been found, and he would have been set free.
How often does something like this happen?
It happens every day. It happens every single day in this country. Just your listeners could literally walk into their county courtroom in the felony courtrooms and just literally they could sit there for a day and watch it happen. The other thing that happens is this even happens among private criminal defense lawyers who will take a very small amount of money for a really serious case because they say to themselves, "Well, I need money this month. I've got to make payroll, pay my secretaries and paralegals. So I'll take this case for practically nothing." Well, it would seem like a lot of money, but they have no business in those serious cases. I saw in my own years of doing this for almost 20 years, even private criminal defense lawyers essentially sell their clients down the river for a plea bargain because they were afraid, literally afraid, to take the case to trial. And you think, well, wait, isn't that why you go to law school? Isn't that because so you can try cases and be in the courtroom? Well, it's a scary place to be, especially as a defense lawyer. And I saw lawyer after lawyer make deals for clients who shouldn't have been in prison for as long as they were. Because why? Because often what we see is this: the prosecutor and the defense lawyer, you know, they need to get along because of all the cases they have together. They need to get along with the judge. Everybody gets along. I didn't do that. I mean, I wasn't friends with prosecutors. I didn't go have lunch with prosecutors. I didn't play golf with judges. I mean, I don't play golf, but I didn't play golf with judges or socialize with them because I considered myself essentially in an adversary position to them. They were not my friends. And no wonder I could only do it for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a hard life when you love it, like I did, but it's an even harder life when you stop loving it, like I did. So I couldn't do it anymore. And it wasn't the death threats. I had people who wanted to kill me, legitimate death threats, but that wasn't what stopped me.
So it's possible that you probably don't give much thought to the cleaning products you use, whether that's dishwashing liquid, laundry detergent, or a spray-on cleaner. If you're like me, you just probably picked up whatever was on the shelf that could get the job done. Well, it turns out that most of the household cleaning products that we use are filled with chemicals that can be really toxic and harmful, not just for our environment, but for our health as well. And that's why I'm really excited about the fact that Grove.co decided to sponsor the podcast. They're on a mission to help every family create and sustain a healthy, beautiful home, which aligns with our mission to help improve the quality of your personal and professional lives. Remember that as unmistakable creative badcast Jim Bunch once said, everything that you see, hear, smell, taste, and touch is an environment that has an impact on your life, and that includes the products that you clean with. In addition to selling eco-friendly, non-toxic products, Grove also gives you a personal concierge to help you make your purchases, which is crazy for a company that sells cleaning products. And when you buy from Grove.co, you're not just supporting the unmistakable creative, you're actually helping the planet. So visit Grove.co/creative for your first purchase and a discount on that purchase. Again, that's grove.co/creative. What's our path out of this? I know people, there's a woman who had written the book called The New Jim Crow, which is next on my list to read. If I remember correctly, her name is Michelle Williams. But what is the path out of this, and how much money do we spend on this as a country?
The first thing is an education and realization among people of all political backgrounds that the dollars we spend early in life are going to give us a great return on investment later in life. And so until we understand spending money birth to age 5 and understand the investments that are required, especially among those in poverty around this country at that level, we're never going to get this cycle. It will continue no matter how much sentencing reform we have. We have to invest money early in order to do what we can to lift these populations up out of poverty, getting education, and not discriminating against them in our sentencing laws. Now, from a practical standpoint, there's this debate in Congress about whether or not reformers should sort of take a small bite of the apple, and that is vote in favor of sentencing reform as opposed to holding back and wanting the whole apple of criminal justice reform. Well, I happen to be in the camp that sentencing reform is not enough. It isn't enough. It's good, but it isn't enough. And so we need to have a systemic criminal justice reform happen from top to bottom. And you know what? When I was in high school in the mid-70s, I was on the debate team. We literally debated this topic that you and I are talking about right now. Now, you know the other topic that we debated? National health care. So we've been talking about this stuff for decades, and I don't see light at the end of the tunnel right now. I really don't. And especially, I don't want to get, unless you want to, get political about regime at the Department of Justice. They are not going to be advocates of this kind of reform that we're talking about. It's just not. I mean, I don't see it happening. I mean, when it costs more to incarcerate a person than it does to send them to Harvard or fill in the blank university, something is really, really wrong with the system. And until we do kind of what I was saying in the beginning of this chat, that we start investing younger, mm-hmm. This isn't going to change. It's not going to change.
Well, I think that really makes a perfect segue to talk about how you get from being a criminal defense attorney to starting a chocolate company. That doesn't seem like the most logical sequence of steps. So what was it that finally caused you to break and decide you couldn't do it anymore? And how did that manifest in the form of a chocolate company?
There was a murder trial that concluded, and that I talk a little bit about that in the book. And at the end of that case, my client, this woman, this very small woman, at the end of this murder trial, which I won, I didn't even realize it at the time because I was still in battle mode right before closing argument. And we were in this little room, and I was explaining to her what the judge just said, that we were going to win the case. And she said, "Sean, it's over." And the roles really switched dramatically between lawyer, advocate, and client, where she became, in a sense, my protector. I became emotional. I started crying, and she held me. And I didn't know it at the time, but reflecting back on it over time, I realized that that was the moment when I said, "I can't do this anymore. I can't." And so what I did is I started to really say, where's my next inspiration? I loved this for so long. Where's my next inspiration? I became desperate even about it. And I had a prayer that I said every day, sometimes many times a day, which was, "Dear God, please give me something else to do." And that just kind of became my mantra and my prayer. And I did this for 5 years. Looking. And the more desperate I became, the further away it was. And I didn't have some lifelong love of chocolate. But here's what I did. And this is, I believe, the key concept of the bridge that literally appeared before me to get from law to chocolate. And here's what happened. I decided it was time to really have a conversation with the grief in my life, with my broken heart over my father's death. And so what I did is I started volunteering in a local hospital's palliative care unit. Palliative care is just hospice in the hospital, essentially, people dying. And I volunteered on Fridays when I was in town. I did this for almost 5 years, and they would give me people to visit. Some in oncology, some cardiology, some neurology, but the people were in some state of dying, and most of them had no visitors, you know, relatives or friends. And so I would just visit. I would just go into their room and talk to them, have simple conversations, sometimes read to them. And at the end of my visit, I said to them, I said, "Hey, one of the things I do as a volunteer is I pray for people. Would you like me to say a prayer for you?" And I found that 99% of people in palliative care will take a prayer. And I said, "Well, what would you like me to pray for?" And this is the key, because it was opposite of what happened to me as a teenager. I said, "What would you like me to pray for?" And they would say, "Would you pray that I live 2 more weeks to my 65th wedding anniversary? Or would you pray that I die today because I'm in such pain, I'm ready to go? Or would you pray for my family that they're okay after I die?" And I would ask if I could touch their shoulder or their hand. And I would say their exact words back to them. And here's what happened. In those moments, measured in seconds, I actually thought about someone besides me. I'd been so wrapped up in, what am I going to do? And where's my next career? And what am I going to invest my money? And just all of that. And then some days when I left the hospital and I was walking to my car in the parking lot, it was as if my feet weren't on the ground. That they were like 3 or 4 feet above the ground, like I was walking on air to my car. What is that? It's joy. And so I quote Khalil Gibran, and would bring him in now to say, he says, "Our greatest joy is our sorrow unmasked." I believe that with everything that I have, that our greatest joy is our sorrow unmasked. And so that's what was happening. When I'm walking out to the car and I'm walking on air, this is the expression of joy from the depth of my broken heart. And so this paradox of finding yourself when you lose yourself in service of others, as Gandhi says, happened to me. So I didn't even know it was happening at the time, but this service created a space for me to think about my future, not while I was at the hospital praying, but just during that time of my life. And so I encourage people every chance I get to examine their own brokenheartedness and to think about what joy can be born of that.
Wow. Well, let's do this. I know that one of the things that really struck me about the way that you've chosen to build the company is that there's a great sense of generosity to this. I know you share profits with farmers. You donate school lunches. Where does that come from? Is that something that was embedded early in your childhood, or is that just something that's evolved with time?
I think both. You know, I spent a lot of time in high school, even in service projects. And I think a lot of this, both of my parents were very active in the community. My dad as a lawyer, my mom just as a community volunteer. And so I sort of grew up with that. And I think that over time, even in my law career, I worked on pro bono cases. I worked to achieve social justice, starting programs in my community. I started a grief center for children who've experienced the death of a parent or sibling almost 20 years ago. I'm still very active in that. So this kind of life has really just, I think, been part of me. But when I started the business almost 13 years ago, it wasn't a question of, hey, do you think I should do some good in this business too, along with my chocolate bars? The way this company came about, the doing good part has always been inseparable from the resulting product, from the chocolate bar. They are literally intertwined together to such a point that they can't be separated. And so those questions were not, should we or should we not? It was just part of the business. So when we're a small business, just 16 people. And as you said, we profit share with farmers. I open my books to them. I translate my financials into their language. So in July, when I'm back in Tanzania, it'll be in Swahili. I'll be taking local high school kids with me. That's almost our 10th year of this Chocolate University program. We have a school lunch program in the Philippines, and we just concluded one in Tanzania. We've funded over a million lunches in the villages near where we buy cocoa beans, all self-sustaining with no donations. And the thing of it is, these works, that is working directly with farmers, working with local students in Springfield, in our neighborhood, in our area, working with students in Tanzania, this is wrapped up in our vocation of making the best tasting direct trade chocolate that we can make. It's all together. And I don't even know what it would be like for them not to be together. So that's, I don't know if I answered your question, but
yeah,
that's the way we do it.
Yeah. In the book, there's this quote that struck me. You said, meaningful worth is both internal and external. It's internal in that I have a sense of personal dignity during the workday because of who I am, not what I do. This is a daily practice, not an event. Meaningful work is external, though, in that I hope to let the light of my dignity be a lamp for my fellow workers and shine collectively upon the work we decide to do together for good purposes. And the idea of this being a daily practice, I think, is what struck me. And the question was, how can we make this a daily practice in our own lives?
Well, the first way to make it a daily practice is to want to do it and to have this awareness that it can happen and it won't be perfect. It will absolutely be imperfect, and it will be something we're stretching towards. But I think one of the things to do is to make it part of our morning intention for the day, whether it's through meditation or prayer or both, or simply journaling. And that's not simply, but I mean, journaling is, I think, an important way of stating our intentions for the morning. And so that's the first thing, I think. The second thing is to not overcomplicate it and to understand that we, despite whatever our role may be in our workplace, whether it's the founder or the CEO, or we're the salesperson or the chocolate maker or whatever, but we, when we consider our role, to understand that there are literally, there are two aspects to us. That is what we're thinking about, what our mind is on, how we are thinking throughout the day. And so that is internal, but there's an expression of it. The expression of that light or that mindfulness is external, that people can see, they can feel. And so if we are just aware of it and we don't overcomplicate it, then it follows naturally. The other thing I think is important is it's much more conducive in a workplace that has as a component peace. That is a peaceful place of work. That's something that I strive for here at our chocolate factory. So that means that sometimes we even turn away business because I value the peacefulness, the lack of chaos as a place where this kind of practice that we're talking about is more possible. And so this could be, I talk about something called a Gemba walk in the book. And this is a Japanese practice where people are checking in with employees, and it's actually more than that. But for me, because the factory is so small, I just did it just before you and I started talking, and it wasn't complicated. I was just walking through the factory, talking with people. Some of the conversations were deep. One of our employees, his wife just had a major surgery, and we were talking about that and how her recovery was going, literally while he was standing there working, making chocolate. Another group of ladies who were packaging the chocolate that had worked with me for almost a decade, we were joking around. We were laughing. That's it. That's all we were doing. But yet there was an interaction between us as human beings. And I believe that this is where we have the chance. This is where we have the chance to express our compassion, to express kindness, to listen, and to be present right then, to be present right in that moment. And that's what this is about. That is what I was writing about from what you just read.
You know, it's interesting because I was journaling this morning, and I don't know why this thought came to me. It's almost serendipitous. I said, you know, when any platform is used solely for the purpose of individual gain, we waste a profound opportunity to change collective consciousness and ignite social movements that have the potential to move humanity forward. Whether that platform is a political position, a company, a job, or a creative endeavor, we hold a great deal of power in our hands.
Oh, man. You wrote that?
Yeah, it was, you
dang.
Know, but I think it was reflective of the fact that of many of the conversations I've been having, especially, you know, when we, you know, talk to somebody like you who makes chocolate, but we spend 20 minutes talking about the injustices of a criminal justice system that is clearly biased towards, you know, people of certain economic status.
Yes, and that's the other thing I think too, and that is really core to what you just said, what you wrote this morning, is that not only do we possess this power, but we possess it regardless of our position in the workplace. Or, I mean, Viktor Frankl talks about this in Man's Search for Meaning. I mean, the greatest freedom that we have is in between the stimulus and the response. And it is a great freedom. And I think that we sometimes don't give ourselves enough credit because we think that our company isn't big enough, or we aren't big enough, that our brand isn't recognizable enough, that we don't have enough followers, that we don't have enough of these things, that we then minimize the ideas that we have and the power that we have. Because also encapsulated in what you just said is the fact that this, the recognition of this power, no matter how small we may perceive it to be, that is true sustainability. That is true change when we recognize that this can happen just within us, just our own heart transforming. is really the true sustainable change in the world. I mean, Gandhi talked about it, and this is that's what this is. And we need to stop. I mean, you talk about this, that people need to have permission to recognize the value of their own ideas that are awesome and not de-minimized because they don't have huge scaling opportunities.
Yeah.
That's what I hope people will remember about a lot of your work is centered on that, I believe.
You know, it's interesting because this was the other quote I wanted to ask you about was, you know, so the danger is with scale, we risk losing some of the benefits of our vocation. We tend to lose ourselves. We lose our connection and kinship under the intense focus of scale for scale's sake. And it's important to know that there's honor and validity in ideas that are not scalable. And at the same time, what we do as a culture is we glorify the accomplishments of billionaires. We put their pictures on magazines. And, you know, there's this almost, you know, sort of toxic drive to profit at all costs, but systemic consequences where we're seeing inequality like we've never seen it before. And I'm a business owner, so I definitely, you know, believe in a lot of the tenets of capitalism. But I can't help but ask you what your view is on the sort of current state of the economic situation we're in, given all of this.
The problem is, and we can start at, you know, we can start with capitalism and then talking about the American economy. And then we talk about the health and well-being of companies and employees that are working in those companies. But the bottom line is that we have been cultured. I mean, we have been conditioned in this culture for decades to measure the health of our companies and our country and other countries on GDP. So it's this mindset of we are not going to be healthy without consumption and increased levels of consumption. That's it. Well, what comes from that is this, as you said, this almost toxic drive and recognition of scale. And investors want to know. They want to know, will this scale? How quickly will it scale? What resources do you need to scale? Because they want this ROI. You know, they want this return. And then chambers of commerce want to know. I mean, we're seeing this happen now. Chambers of commerce want to know because it means more jobs. Your family wants to know because they think it means you'll be rich if you can scale. And so this pressure to grow and grow and grow is something that is very hard to resist. It is alluring in many ways. And of course, there are places where we must scale in terms of poverty alleviation and hunger alleviation, malaria, diseases. We need to scale solutions to that as quickly as possible. But what I'm talking about are these other things. And so what I think we're finding is that we are in our pursuit of scale, we're losing our sense of humanity because of what you read that I wrote. And it's hard to find yourself when you're distanced from others. And what we end up doing as entrepreneurs, as founders, as CEOs, really in any job, this would apply, and that is we grow, we scale, the top line growth is big, the profits are big. And what we find, we turn around and one day we realize that we have lost the thing that brought us to this place to begin with. We have become untethered to our vocation because we've become busy managing and writing checks and delegating. And pretty soon we've lost the human scale of our business that drew us to it in the first place, whatever it may be, practicing law, writing, making chocolate. It doesn't matter. The application is the same for all of those. And so what I'm suggesting is that people take a step back, take a deep breath and say, wait, what? I see the attraction here, but do I need to do this? And if I do this, how can I have a daily practice of reverse scale? That is, how can I turn this pyramid upside down and say, does this idea, this good idea, can I say that this has value if it only impacts one person? Or what if it just impacts me? Is it still worthy? Can I ascribe value to that? And in the process, am I practicing reverse scale? That is, am I practicing holding on to this line, this tether to the thing that brought me here to begin with? And is it worth sacrificing some growth and scale in order to keep it? And I say yes. And it's happened to me just so many times. And here's what it looks like. When I practice reverse scale, it means that I didn't delegate somebody else to take students to Africa on this trip to Tanzania, where it takes 60 hours to get there from door to door. I didn't, and I don't delegate that to other people. And one day we're driving with the students. We've spent 60 hours getting to this place. Many of these students have never even been on an airplane before. They're very bright students. We're riding on this bus. It's dusty. They're tired because we've just come all this way. And we're on this little road near the village leading up to a school that we have this Chocolate University partnership with. There are 1,000 kids in that school, many of them very hungry kids who we've tried to help alleviate in a school lunch program. They come spilling out of the school down this little gravel drive, and our bus with 20 people pulls up, and all of these kids are singing this song in English. We are happy. We are happy to be together. Our people get off the bus, including me, and we're just enveloped in this hospitality. And there wasn't a dry eye in the group, including me. I've been all over the world. Why? Why is that? It's because we aren't built for that kind of hospitality. We couldn't take it. It was like this blanket coming over us, and everybody was emotional about it. And in that moment, and in the moments that have followed, when I've looked at that pictures of that scene, I thought, well, that's what heaven's going to be like. Maybe I'll get off this little rickety bus called a coaster in Tanzania. I'll get off and people will be singing a little song. Then I realized, no, that's not what heaven's going to be like. It was heaven. And it doesn't matter your religion. I'm not proselytizing. I'm saying it was the divine. It was a moment of heaven, just a glimpse. And here's what it did. Because I didn't delegate that trip to somebody else, and I wanted to stay tethered to my vocation, I had a glimpse of my true self. That is the thing that points me back to my vocation. And so I was able to have this experience at work. And I say to people, man, can you find a way to experience the divine at work? It's not going to be every day. I'm not talking about that. But can you have a life at work that you have the chance to experience this? And my point is that I'm not saying you will lose the chance if you scale. What I'm saying is that the chance is less likely if you scale and don't remain true to yourself and don't keep that sense of human connection. And that's a practice, because we're resisting our culture.
Wow. So I have two last questions for you. I know, probably made plenty of money as a criminal defense attorney from what I gathered from the book. You've built a successful business, and you've also been up close to poverty in a way that most of us will never see it. How has all of this informed your perspective on money and wealth?
The thing for me about money and wealth, and I now, as a chocolate maker, I probably make about 15% of what I made as a lawyer. And that's been that way for a long time, but it's enough. And so the way that this has informed my view of money and wealth, and I write about this, the title of the chapter is, How Much is Enough? That's, man, I have to ask myself that question every day. I want stuff. I mean, I don't want a Gulfstream 4, but I mean, maybe, you know, just a Citation would do. No, I'm just kidding. But I'm saying I have a want desire as well. But what I'm saying is that if we can have a practice of asking ourselves that simple question, how much is enough? It actually relates to the last thing that we were just talking about. It relates to scale, because if I can answer that question and recognize that it's a moving target, then I'm going to be one step closer to what? To knowing what is sufficient. This comes straight from the Rule of Benedict, which has been governing monasteries around the world for 1500 years. I write about this. And because of my experience at the monastery, I'm able to overlay some of that Rule of Benedict on the practices that we have in our chocolate factory. And we're not a monastery, but I love that practice of, you know, the monks that brew beer, brew enough beer. The monks that make fruitcake, they make enough fruitcake. And all of our definitions of enough are going to be different. But when we can come together and have some consensus in our companies about, well, is this enough? You know, is this sufficient? Can we at least agree on this target? That's where it's come for me. And so I haven't answered the question. I'm still answering, you know, how much is enough? But the point is, I'm asking the question. And then when I visit with farmers who are so poor that you that it's hard to describe, yet they love me and they care about me and they shower me with hospitality, then I'm caught. I'm literally caught in this mystery of not trying to understand, but to recognize this imbalance of joy and sorrow and how it all fits together in this life. And that's where I want to be. And I want to be reminded of that as often as I possibly can, about this mystery of joy and sorrow, how it relates to money, and how it relates to my view of enough.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a really fitting end to our conversation. So I want to finish with my final question, which is how we close all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think what it is that makes someone unmistakable is the recognition and power that they can understand of their own brokenheartedness in their life, no matter how big or small they may perceive it to be, and understand that their broken heart is what leads them to compassion, to kindness, and to goodness, and ultimately to love, which is what all of this is about. The entire conversation that we've had, and really, frankly, I think your work, I mean, we could boil it down to that. That's what it is.
Well, this has been absolutely amazing. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and your book, and also buy your chocolate?
Oh, thank you. Well, starting with chocolate, it's at askanossi.com. That's my last name.com. And we're on social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And then I'm on LinkedIn myself personally, Sean Askanossi. And then I have a blog at seanaskanossi.com. And the book is Meaningful Work, A Quest to Do Great Business, Find Your Calling, and Feed Your Soul. And that's available in a lot of places and online as well.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.